Adolf Hitler is arguably the most notorious figure in modern history. His name is almost synonymous with evil. Yet Hitler remains something of an enigma, notwithstanding the massive scholarship, memoir, speculation, and outright fantasy that purports to explain him. Hitler biographer Joachim Fest describes him as a non-person, with little substance outside his public persona, a kind of man who wasn't there. Except, of course, he was. Many theories exist as to who or what created Hitler. The underlying assumption is that his rise was no accident. He must have been spawned, groomed, or facilitated by some hidden hand. Perhaps the most provocative claim about Hitler was that he was the anointed prince of dark forces, whose agendas transcend money and politics. In this lecture, we'll explore the role that secret societies played, or might have played, in Hitler's rise, how they influenced his beliefs, and how the Nazi leader came to embrace secret society methods for his own purposes. You could say that things began with Germany's unification in 1871. That combined some 24 previously independent kingdoms, duchies, and free cities into a single German empire. But Germans remained divided by religion, dialect, and history. Completely excluded were several million Austro-Germans living in the neighboring Austro-Hungarian Empire. One of them was Adolf Hitler. In an effort to bind the Germans into a single people, many scholars and artists sought to create a common German culture, history, and even mythology. The German composer Richard Wagner's Ring Cycle is a prime example. Some on the esoteric end of things went further. They dreamed of a Germanic religion and a Germanic manifest destiny. Two such men were the racial theorist Jörg Lanz von Liebenfels and the occultist Guido von Liszt. Like Hitler, both were Austro-Germans. Liebenfels and Liszt fathered small secret societies devoted to Germanic racial mysticism. Liebenfels called it Ariosophy, meaning wisdom of the Aryans. Others called it the Folkish movement. Liebenfels imagined the Aryan race as the spawn of godlike aliens. He and those like him saw modern Germans as the purest surviving example of these divine supermen. In 1908, Liebenfels formed a secret brotherhood called the Ordo Novi Templi, or New Templars, to promote German racial consciousness. He also produced a magazine called Ostara. In Vienna, a young, down-and-out Adolf Hitler was among its readers. Guido von Liszt yearned for nothing less than the resurrection of Germanic paganism, complete with the worship of warrior gods like Wotan and the use of magical runes and symbols. Among those symbols was the swastika, a potent symbol in many cultures. Liszt's teaching spawned a whole constellation of secret societies. The two most important were the Reichshammerbund, or Reichshammer League, and the Germanenorden, or German Order, which appeared in 1912. The Germanenorden was really a secret society within a secret society, the inner circle of the larger Reichshammerbund. But at the center of the Germanenorden was yet another group, the all-powerful Council of Seven, whose identities were secret. This nesting doll pattern is common among secret societies. These Ariosophist societies weren't large. They probably had no more than a few thousand members in a nation of over 60 million. And they had little influence on the wider German public. But within these brotherhoods, the seeds of Nazism were waiting for the right conditions to grow. Those came with the First World War in 1914. The European conflict decimated the ranks of the Ariosophist orders while also opening the door to younger and harder men. The war brutalized and radicalized millions of men, one of them being Corporal Hitler. But Adolf doesn't enter the picture quite yet. First came Rudolf von Zebotendorf, the man who would truly set the stage for Hitler. Zebotendorf has been described as a spectacular version of the shady and mysterious adventurer who attaches himself vehemently to an extreme nationalist cause. Born Adam Glauer, he got his new name and title through a dubious adult adoption. He popped up in the decaying Turkish Ottoman Empire at the turn of the 20th century, in pursuit of riches and spiritual enlightenment. Zaboutendorf joined a mystical Sufi order and received initiation into a Masonic lodge that was connected to the secretive Rite of Memphis Mizraim. You'll hear its name crop up again and again in these lectures. Zaboutendorf's sponsor was a Jewish Freemason and occultist named Termudi. Their lodge was one of the incubators of the Young Turk Revolution that seized control of the teetering Ottoman Empire in 1908. The Rite of Memphis Mizraim was an irregular order, not recognized by most conventional Masons. Its roots stretch back to the French Revolution. It first appeared in 1814 as an offshoot of so-called Egyptian Freemasonry. The inventor of that was the 18th century Italian occultist, charlatan, and intriguer, Count Alessandro Cagliostro. In the 1830s, these Egyptian lodges became intertwined with a revolutionary order known as the Society of the Seasons, led by radical socialist Louis-Auguste Blanqui. And the Society of Seasons drew inspiration from another 18th century secret society, the Illuminati. In the 1880s, the Memphis and Mizraim rites were formally combined under a high priest or Grand Hierophant. The first Hierophant was the Italian Freemason and revolutionary Giuseppe Garibaldi. The key thing to notice in all of this is that Memphis Mizraim Freemasonry had a long history of association with political intrigues. Zaboutendorf enjoyed a cozy relationship with the Young Turks, and it was the Young Turks who took over the Ottoman government before World War I. Under the influence of nationalist and racialist doctrines, the Young Turks degenerated into a murderous cabal, later responsible for the Armenian genocide. Note that the future Nazis will follow a rather similar course. In 1913, Zaboutendorf returned to Germany from Turkey. There he styled himself as an occult sage and agent of mysterious paymasters. One associate said, "I had the impression he was always an intelligence operative and worked for several different services." In Turkey, Zaboutendorf had observed how an esoteric organization could be exploited for propaganda and political conspiracy. Doubtless with that in mind, Zaboutendorf joined the aforementioned Germanenorden. He might have been working as an agent for the German army. War weariness was spreading, and the Kaiser's officials wanted to stem the rising tide of pacifism and radicalism. The Germanenorden was vociferously pro-war and anti-left. If it could be strengthened, it might act as a counterweight to defeatism and revolution. Zaboutendorf took charge of the Germanenorden's Munich branch. He renamed it the Thule Gesellschaft, or Thule Society, in homage to a mythical Aryan homeland near the North Pole. Zaboutendorf devised an emblem featuring a ceremonial dagger superimposed on a swastika. The Thule Society's motto was Blut und Erde, blood and earth. Zaboutendorf immediately steered Thule into political intrigue. His headquarters was Munich's posh Four Seasons Hotel. Thule's outwardly seemed a bunch of cranks who met over tea to natter about runes and astrology. Secretly, they plotted to seize political control. Zaboutendorf next created the Rings of Thule. These were satellite study societies. One such study society was the Political Workers' Circle. It aimed to counteract socialism and Bolshevism among the working class. This was the seed of the Nazi Party. In November 1918, revolution swept Germany. Kaiser Wilhelm abdicated, and the armistice finally ended World War I. Germany now fell into the hands of socialists, but they splintered into factions. On the far left was the new Communist Party, or KPD, which aimed to emulate the Russian Bolsheviks. In April 1919, a Bavarian Soviet Republic arose in Munich. It was taken over by communists loyal to Russia's Vladimir Lenin. Seven members of the Thule Society were taken hostage and executed by the Munich Reds on April 30, 1919. But the Bavarian Soviet Republic soon collapsed. It was overthrown by the right-wing Freikorps, many of whose soldiers had swastikas painted on their helmets. Watching all of this happen was Hitler. While millions of German veterans returned home, Hitler wasn't one of them. He remained on the Army's payroll until April 1920. During the Soviet Republic, Hitler was particularly close to Munich's Revolutionary Soldiers' Councils, even wearing a red armband. After the communists were defeated, Hitler switched sides and was enlisted to investigate the political reliability of other soldiers. Basically, he ratted out Reds. In May 1919, Hitler came to the attention of Captain Karl Mayer, chief of the German Army's Section IBP, which handled education and propaganda. Mayer was also involved in the secret financing of patriotic parties, publications, and organizations. Among those was the Botendorf's Thule Society. Captain Mayer described Hitler as a stray dog looking for a master. Mayer sent him to attend lectures at Munich University. One of Hitler's instructors was Gottfried Feder, a Thule member who aimed to instill correct political and ideological thinking. Hitler became a V-man, or agent informant of military intelligence. On September 12, 1919, Mayer assigned him to attend a meeting of the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the German Workers' Party, or DAP. Less than 50 people were there. Hitler called it an absurd little organization. He listened to a talk titled, "How and by what means can capitalism be eliminated?" The DAP detested Marxism, but also hated capitalism. It saw both as manifestations of Jewish influence. To counter the international socialism of the Judeo-Bolsheviks, the DAP wanted to create national socialism based on the German nation and Aryan race. Hitler became involved in a debate after the talk. Members of the DAP, impressed by his speaking skills, invited him to join and put him in charge of party propaganda. Hitler claimed to have no prior knowledge of the DAP or the Thule Society. That wasn't exactly true. The man who delivered the anti-capitalist talk that night was Hitler's recent instructor and Thule member, Gottfried Feder. Hitler's army boss, Captain Mayer, was well acquainted with Zeboten-Dorf and Thule and used its propaganda in the training of his V-men, including Hitler. The founder of the German Workers' Party, a railway man named Anton Drexler, had attended Thule gatherings as a guest for months. Drexler had combined his struggling party with Thule's political worker circle. Thus, DAP was a ring of Thule. In his 1933 memoir, Before Hitler Came, Zeboten-Dorf claimed that Hitler entered the halls of Thule in the summer of 1919. If true, Hitler was connected to the Thule Society before he joined the German Workers' Party. And that summer, Hitler applied for a job with the Münchener Beobachter, a small newspaper controlled by the Thule Society. So there's no way he was ignorant of its existence. Still, there's no proof Hitler was ever a member. But the American author and lecturer David Lurson is probably right to suggest that Hitler, like Drexler, attended Thule meetings as a guest. That makes sense because the German army, Hitler's employer, forbade soldiers to join organizations requiring an oath of allegiance. Zeboten-Dorf quit the Thule Society just before Hitler appeared on the scene. Among other things, he'd been accused of financial improprieties. Socialist opponents raised questions about Zeboten-Dorf's citizenship, phony nobility, and past intrigues in Turkey. Or did some in the army brass want Zeboten-Dorf out of the way to make room for their new man, Hitler? The commander in Munich, General Arnold Ritter von Moll, also cut ties to Zeboten-Dorf and accused him of spreading anti-Semitism among the troops. And von Moll was Captain Mayer's superior, meaning he was also Hitler's. In any case, soon after Hitler came on board, the DAP changed its name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party. The idea was that National Socialist would better highlight the party as an alternative to communism's international socialism. But Subotendorf didn't completely sever ties to Thule and its rings. He retained control over the Münchener Beobachter newspaper before selling it to Hitler in 1921. Rechristened the Völkische Beobachter, it became the Nazis' main mouthpiece. However, without Subotendorf at the helm, Thule gradually withered. By 1925, it was down to a few dozen members. 5 years later, it vanished from the registered secret societies in Weimar Germany. Meanwhile, under Hitler's leadership, the new Nazi party began to grow. Clearly, the German army was the guiding hand that steered Hitler into the Nazi party. Under the Treaty of Versailles, the army was limited to 100,000 men. The once-vaunted German general staff was prohibited. But the military elite used secrecy and conspiracy to evade these restrictions. Under the Machiavellian guidance of General Hans von Seeckt, they even created the so-called Black Reichswehr, a secret force that enrolled thousands of officers and men. Most army leaders despised the Weimar Republic and acted like a state within a state. The German high command conspired with racists, occultists, and even communists to get what they wanted. All is fair in love and politics. Communism remained Germany's main internal threat. Fighting it required not just anti-communism, but counter-communism. Again, think national socialism. By February 1920, Hitler was firmly established in the Nazi Party's leadership. That month, the Nazis adopted a 25-point program. They had planks red enough to warm the heart of any Bolshevik. Nationalization of industry, confiscation of war profits, abolition of usury and debt, and sweeping expansion of social welfare. They even promised equal rights and freedom of religion. The program mentioned Jews only as non-Aryans undeserving of German citizenship and in the party's opposition to the Jewish materialistic spirit. Hitler's personal anti-Semitism went much further, yet its origin and even sincerity are far from clear. Consider an interview Hitler gave to the journalist Josef Hell in 1922. First, he boasted that, "Once I really am in power, my first and foremost task will be the annihilation of the Jews." But when Hell asked him why, Hitler gave a dispassionate explanation. He said, "My aim is to create first-rate revolutionary upheavals, regardless of what methods and means I have to use in the process." He looked around and decided that Jews were the ideal scapegoats. German Jews, though less than 1% of Germany's population, were prominent, prosperous, and widely held in suspicion. Hitler said, "Once the hatred and the battle against the Jews have been really stirred up, their resistance will necessarily crumble in the shortest possible time. They are totally defenseless, and no one will stand up to protect them." So who was the real Hitler? The blood-curdling Jew-baiter or the amoral propagandist? Did he believe his own propaganda? Or did he promote it because others would believe it? Did he let something slip when he called himself a creator of first-rate revolutionary upheavals? Was he really a calculating opportunist, a man who believed in nothing besides his ambition and the opportunities offered by chaos? Or was he, perhaps without fully realizing it, the tool of someone or something else? The usual story is that once Hitler took charge, the Nazi Party began an inexorable rise. Wrong. The Nazi ascent was neither steady nor inevitable. And Hitler never seized power. It was handed to him legally. Nazi political fortunes were tied directly to the economic fortunes of the Weimar Republic. In 1922, German unemployment was less than 2%. A year later, it spiked to more than 10%. At the same time, hyperinflation destroyed the German currency, the mark. Back in 1920, the Nazis were a regional party with barely 3,000 members. By autumn 1923, they swelled to 25,000 or more. But in a nation of 65 million with 35 million voters, that was a drop in the bucket. But a fresh wave of political and economic crises encouraged Hitler to launch an ill-conceived bid to seize power in late 1923. This so-called beer hall putsch was a complete fiasco and landed Hitler in prison. But it also gave him national recognition. Hitler's party entered national politics in May 1924. It grabbed only 6.5% of the vote. Inflation and unemployment came under control. A second vote in December 1924 gave the Nazis only 3%. In May 1928, the Nazi vote dwindled to 2.6%. The Nazis were a party going nowhere fast. This brought challenges to Hitler's leadership. One rival was the Nazi boss in Berlin, Gregor Strasser. Strasser emphasized the socialism in National Socialism. He considered Hitler way too cozy with Germany's capitalists. In response, Hitler organized a personal guard dubbed the Schutzstaffel, or SS. In 1926, Hitler rammed through measures giving him absolute power over party doctrine and organization. But Gregor Strasser created his own secret organization and continued to plot against Hitler. Strasser wasn't wrong about Hitler being soft on capitalism. The party needed money, and big business was an important source of it. Two examples were steel magnate Fritz Thyssen and coal king Emil Kirdorf. German industry and finance was a tight-knit community dominated by giant cartels, such as IG Farben. One could say that Germany's business elite itself operated as a secret society. They had no love for Hitler, but saw Nazism as a useful counterweight to communism. Hitler was the reasonable Nazi who kept anti-capitalist firebrands like Strasser in check. Money also came in from Italian dictator Benito Mussolini, who was willing to toss a few crumbs at his Bavarian imitator. Anglo-Dutch oil tycoon Sir Henry Detterding was another contributor, as was American automaker and anti-Semite Henry Ford. Yet another alleged funder is Moses Pinkeles, or Pinkele, supposedly a wealthy Munich Jew who helped Hitler buy the Münchener Beobachter newspaper from Subotendorf. Except that Moses Pinkeles never existed. He's likely a muddled reference to Arthur Trebitsch, a rich backer of the early Nazis. And Trebitsch was, strange as it may seem, of Jewish origin. That also explains why Pinkeles was conflated with another Trebitsch, Ignatius Trebitsch Lincoln, a notorious international adventurer and secret society initiate, and also Jewish. However, according to German detective Herbert Folk, Pinkele was the alias of a man with one foot in London and the other in the Soviet embassy in Berlin. Folk identified him as Sir Basil Zaharoff, the non-Jewish arms king. According to Folk, Zaharoff bought surplus German war material and sold it to the Soviets. The German army thus raked in secret cash, some of which might have ended up in Hitler's hands. Zaharoff was also called Europe's man of mystery. Besides being a millionaire arms dealer, he was also a member of at least three secret societies, the Rosicrucians, the Freemasons, and that pesky rite of Memphis Mizraim. I told you it would keep cropping up. Still, Hitler lacked enough cash to mount a sustained national propaganda blitz. That became critical when Nazi opportunities changed in 1929. The Wall Street crash of October 1929 started a global financial meltdown that hit Germany especially hard. German unemployment crept back over 13%. By 1930, it leapt to 23%, and Hitler's party captured 18% of the votes. Almost overnight, the Nazis became the second largest political force in the German parliament, the Reichstag. German historian Friedrich Hirt noted that the Nazis suddenly seemed awash in money, enough to fund a flood of propaganda. By 1932, joblessness reached 43%, and the Nazis became the Reichstag's largest party. In two elections in 1932, Hitler's party polled 37% and 33% of the vote. This made him a viable candidate for chancellor. But it still took backroom plotting by a cabal of politicians, military officers, and industrialists to make that happen. But where did all that Nazi cash come from? One purported answer appears in a strange book published in the Netherlands in 1933, The Financial Origins of National Socialism. It claimed to be the memoir of an American banker named Sidney Warburg. According to the book, between 1929 and 1933, a cabal of Wall Street and London bankers used Warburg as a go-between to provide Hitler with $32 million. It names the American financier John D. Rockefeller Jr., along with Bank of England Governor Montague Norman and Royal Dutch Petroleum Chairman Henry Detterding among the conspirators. However, while there was a whole family of Warburg bankers, none of them were named Sidney. And the fictional Sidney Warburg shuttling back and forth across the Atlantic doesn't match the recorded movements of anyone named Warburg at this time. Moreover, while the book references real events, it has them out of sequence. And the Warburgs were Jewish. The best guess is that the real author of the book was the man listed as its translator, a Belgian writer and con man named Jean-Gustave Schupp. One theory is that Schupp's source was Hitler's rival, Gregor Strasser. Putting Hitler in bed with foreign capitalists, Jewish ones no less, suited Strasser nicely. Under mysterious but powerful pressure, presumably from the Nazis, the publisher pulled and pulped the book. Only a few copies survived. Or was this a burn operation? The truth mixed with a spoonful of fiction to discredit everything and any future revelations. A similar story is spun by the American historian Guido Preparata. While Preparata doesn't even mention Schupp, he advances the provocative notion that the Great Depression, beginning in 1929, was no accident. Rather, it was orchestrated by a secret brotherhood of international bankers. Their supposed aim was to create chaos that would facilitate the rise of Hitler and others like him. Preparata, in his book Conjuring Hitler, claims that for 15 years, from 1919 to 1933, the Anglo-Saxon elites tampered with German politics with the conscious intent of obtaining a reactionary movement, which they could then set up as a pawn for their geopolitical intrigues. In Preparata's scenario, no matter how much Hitler might have believed himself master, he was nothing but a tool. But Preparata's theorizing pales beside that of New Zealand historian Greg Hallett. In Hitler Was a British Agent, Hallett paints Hitler as a psychologically conditioned pawn created by occult magicians bent on world conquest. One of these magicians was supposedly the English occultist Aleister Crowley. Crowley allegedly, and improbably, even functioned as Hitler's guide and guru. A like theme crops up in Trevor Ravenscroft's popular book, The Spear of Destiny. In this, Hitler becomes an occult monster crafted by black magicians. Ravenscroft also invokes the sinister presence of Crowley. While Ravenscroft's fantastic claims aren't supported by a shred of credible evidence, that hasn't stopped them from being widely disseminated and believed. Even psychoanalyst Carl Jung claimed to sense in Hitler the spirit of the old Germanic war god Wotan. Hitler's supposed connection to sinister forces also features in a strange 1933 French novel called The Seven Heads of the Green Dragon. Its B-movie plot has a British agent named James Nobody digging into the nefarious activities of a global secret society, the Green Dragon. Headed by 72 unknown superiors, it aimed at, What else? World domination. Nobody discovers that the Green Dragon is the hidden hand behind Russian mystic Grigory Rasputin, international con man Trebitch Lincoln, arms dealer Basil Zaharoff, and Adolf Hitler. The book's author, Teddy LeGrand, was probably Javier de Hautecloque, a man closely linked to French intelligence. Some see the book as truth disguised as fiction and believe it even explains Hautecloque's death. He was poisoned in 1935 while on a secret mission to Nazi Germany. The book's references to Hitler and occult secret societies are numerous and intriguing, but don't offer any real answers. In the end, we come back to the German historian Joachim Fest's portrait of Hitler as the unperson, a man with no existence outside his historical character. Hitler becomes a human Rorschach test, that psychological inkblot exam, in which one can see just about anything. None of the theories and stories I've cited can be absolutely discounted any more than they can be definitively proved. Some certainly carry more water than others. And as we've seen, those most visibly responsible for grooming Hitler as a political operative were his army superiors. Whether they ultimately got what they wanted is another question. From another perspective, Hitler was a product of chaos, the secret force that guides all history. There's an old saying, if half of everything that happens is luck, the other half is fate. But sometimes it's neither luck nor fate. It's conspiracy. And where you find that, you'll find secret societies of one kind or another.